Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. It's October 10th, 2017. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Well, the world is in deep trouble. Well, actually, I suppose the world itself is just fine, but humans, maybe not so much. Now, why do I say that? Because of our systemic and collective addiction to growth, economic growth particularly. That growth is destroying ecosystems. It's burning through non-renewable resources and really cannot continue as it did in years and decades past. And when I say the word growth, you know I'm really talking about exponential growth, right? Sneaky, powerful, deceptive, exponential growth. This is the most important and least talked about and possibly least understood concept of our times. By becoming aware of it, you can do many important things in your life, such as predict the future and alter your actions and behaviors to become part of the solution. Steady 3% GDP growth each year? That's exponential. 4% more cars sold each quarter? Exponential. 5% increase in exports this month? Also exponential. Anything growing by some percentage over time is growing exponentially. But we live on a finite planet. And that right there is where our story takes us today. To talk with us about this today is a guest I'm personally very excited to finally have on the program. Professor Tim Jackson is a top sustainability advisor for the UK government, and he is professor of sustainable development at the University of Surrey and director of CUSP. He was, for 7 years, economics commissioner on the UK Sustainable Development Commission, where his work culminated in the publication of Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. Originally a report to the UK government, the work was subsequently translated into 17 languages worldwide. Tim is a full member of the Club of Rome. In addition to all this, he is an award-winning playwright with numerous radio writing credits for the BBC. Welcome, Professor Jackson.
Hey, pleased to be with you.
Thanks, all right, may I call you Tim?
You may, yeah, you may indeed.
Well, you heard my intro, Tim. In your words, what's the big problem with exponential economic and monetary systems on a finite planet? How do you summarize this for people if you have a short amount of time?
Well, I mean, I think I summarize it by sort of saying that if you, as with Kenneth Boulding, that anyone who thinks that exponential growth can go on forever on a finite planet is either a madman or an economist. And there are lots of, you know, visual tricks for seeing what exponential growth means, but those very steep lines that rise very sharply as we approach the 21st century and show us that we are exceeding our carrying capacity in all sorts of ways are quite compelling. And I think people also actually feel this to some extent, that this idea of having more and more and having more and more stuff going through the system is somehow unsustainable in not just in environmental ways, but sometimes also even in social ways. And it's that challenge, really. It's that challenge of, you know, the irresistible force meets the immovable object. This hugely increasing idea of what prosperity consists in terms of exponential growth. And actually the fact that the planet's not getting any bigger, the ecosystems are all under lots of stress. The pressure that human society puts on our environment is increasingly obvious. And it's the sort of conversation that you can have even, you know, with quite young citizens of the planet, with kids almost, and they will get it immediately because it's a sort of inevitability about something getting bigger and bigger when there's no more room to play.
Well, it seems a very simple concept to grasp. And in fact, you've pointed to something I've noticed, which is sometimes the younger the person, the easier it is to communicate, indicating that this maybe is potentially not, it's not an intellectual challenge. It's just basic math, really. Yet gaining traction on this topic has been difficult, to say the least. I would say, you know, what the Club of Rome illustrated in a set of models was some very serious ideas that really should have caused, I think, a lot of very careful thinking. My experience is that trying to educate and illuminate on this topic, this idea of limits, it feels like rolling a boulder up a hill sometimes. That's been my experience. What's yours been?
Yeah, it was very interesting after the report was first published, because it was a report written for the UK government, for the Prime Minister, actually, with the Commission reported formally to the Prime Minister of the UK, and it reported at a fairly sensitive time, because at that time, just after the financial crisis, the Prime Minister had, in fact, invited the G20 leaders. It was the British turn to be leading the G20 meeting, and he'd invited the G20 leaders to London the same week that we launched the report, as it happened. And the whole aim of that conversation amongst the G20 leaders just after the crisis was, how could we kickstart growth? So you can imagine, actually, that a report from one of the government's own advisors saying, actually, maybe we should be questioning growth, was probably not what the government wanted to hear at that point in time. And in fact, they wanted to hear it so little that the report almost died that week. It got virtually no press whatsoever. There were some quite fierce reactions from our departmental sponsors, I would say, and it was the weirdest launch of a report that I've ever encountered in my professional life, where you kind of put all this work in, actually you think it's pretty good work, and you're aware, of course, that you're treading on some political toes, but you hope you've done all your homework, you've included all the government departments in your pre release consultations, they've all turned up at meetings, they've seen the slide deck, they've had a chance to comment on things, and yet we were not prepared for the degree of anxiety around that report from the government, and we were certainly not prepared to find, actually, that nothing happened initially. There was very little response to it whatsoever. And then the weird thing, I suppose, was that very slowly after that, it began to pick up a kind of online presence, almost went viral at a certain point, had these interests from publishers, and then these invitations that started flowing in. And what was extraordinary about that to me was that, although I was aware that I was tackling a kind of taboo subject, what I wasn't aware is how many other people out there were interested in talking about that subject. So it is, as you say, extremely difficult in certain circles to even ask the question. But it was also fascinating that I had invitations from investment banks, from venture capital funds, from literary societies, from women's groups, from industrial companies, from groups of scientists who for 40 or 50 years have been thinking about these very same issues, and a almost humbling response, in a way, that I had somehow put my finger on the pulse of a conversation that was just waiting to be had. And that, I would say, over the intervening years has been my predominant experience, that there's more and more interest in having that conversation.
You know, I have a similar experience having put together something called the Crash Course, which was probably the hardest work I've done in my life, and I've got a PhD. I really burrowed in and had to understand economics, and I wedded that to energy and then also the environmental concerns, and put it at a high-level synthesis thing, not creating anything new, but just connecting dots so people could understand it. And it should have been a disaster, Tim. It's some guy, me, speaking over PowerPoint slides for like 3 hours. It's awful, right? But it caught on.
Yeah.
And also very humbling for me, people spent unbelievable amounts of time translating it all into all multiple languages and carrying the message. And I have the same experience, which is that I call it open door, closed door. So in public, I find that people who are heads of companies or politicians, they have one sort of reaction to it, and then you close the door, and I get the weirdest questions from people. Like, they say things like, so should I start a garden, and what kind of chickens should I get? You know, so they're thinking about this as if it might go very badly if we keep going in business as usual, but they're public face is still business as usual. That is that tide turning, do you think, that the business as usual is now maybe on its heels a little bit in this conversation?
I think business as usual is on its heels for a very specific reason, which is that the idea of growth as we had come to expect it is increasingly seen as being difficult to achieve. In other words, that those exponential growth rates appear in the advanced economies, at least, to be declining very, very specifically. And that's an issue which is not about environmental limits. It's not about resource constraints. It's actually about the economic model itself. And I think that's the one factor that has changed dramatically in the years since the first report was published, in the last 7 years since the crisis. And this, the fact that actually at this point in time, the new normal is a place that may just not have that exponential growth in it. And even quite well-established, very well-established mainstream conventional economists are now beginning to recognize that they may have to rethink all of our assumptions about that normal idea of economic growth. That puts the idea of economic growth and the politics of economic growth much more on the back foot and much more interested in the conversation that you and I would like to have about growth, for perhaps for other reasons. But interestingly, perhaps with even more pressure now to begin to dismantle that taboo and to say, actually, what is the economy of tomorrow going to look like? What are its foundations? How do we build it without reference to this idea that it's continually expanding? Because it just may not be anymore.
And again, a fairly simple math idea to convey, but oh, so entrenched. And I'm intrigued by the title you came up with. I think it's perfect: prosperity without growth. And I think that in a lot of people's minds, growth and prosperity are conflated ideas. If you want one, you need the other. How did you go about detangling those two ideas?
Yeah, that was really one of the first starting points, and it came, I think, from a variety of different directions. One of them was reading work on poverty, actually, from the 1970s, and a real understanding that, of course, at one level, poverty is about income, but actually, much worse things happen on the back of not having income, and they include respect and motivation and fulfillment and your access to being a decent person in a decent society. And those things go missing very, very fast for people when they're not there, sometimes even when they do have an income. And it became clear, in a way, looking at it through this lens of poverty, that the same thing was true of prosperity, that actually it's not and never was just about income. It's a fairly modern conception to align prosperity with the idea of increasing income. And that actually, you know, what matters is the love of our families and the strength of our friendships and the integrity of our communities, our health, our well-being, our sense of meaning and purpose, of having a place in life, of participating in society, and that you can have one without the other. You can have a society which has got this exponential growth built into it and yet is neglecting these fundamental aspects of prosperity. And so it immediately becomes a not altogether absolutely categorically answered question, but a really interesting question. Could you decouple this idea of prosperity from the idea of exponential growth? Could you build a society which had these qualities that really matter to people, and in which their incomes were not necessarily increasing exponentially as we have come to expect them to? And that's a real genuine inquiry. That's a point where you have to look at evidence, where you have to look at case study, where you have to explore the philosophy of what human well-being consists in, and which also, of course, you have to think about the hard economics of delivering that vision of prosperity.
It almost sounds like, you know, there's in the growth phase of an organism, you know, you go through from birth through this rapid growth phase, you hit adulthood. And so our culture as a species, you know, we went very hard charging through all the resources, and now we're sort of getting to adulthood and we have to figure out how we're going to be in this story. And the old story doesn't work anymore. We're not teenagers. We can't just consume endless pizzas and it's all going to work out. You know, we're going to have to keep our room clean. We're going to have to eat well. There's a maturation going on here. The resistance to that idea of really living within limits seems to really rub some people the wrong way. And before we circle back to prosperity, because that's the central theme of what I want to get to here, I want to turn to those limits to growth models and all of that, because there's been lots and lots of criticism and debate about the limits to growth model, their outputs, not all of them fair. I get accused of basically being, you know, some form of Malthusian person as a showstopper all the time, right? But in 2016, yourself and Robin Webster wrote a review of the limits to growth debate titled Limits Revisited. Before we get back to the prosperity side of this, can you set the stage for those who may be unfamiliar with the limits to growth? Tell us what really was it and how it came to be.
Yeah, it was a fascinating piece of work, and partly because it's at the center of it doesn't sit a set of Malthusian projections about the world coming to end by a certain date. At the center of it sits a very profound insight about the nature of resource consumption on a finite world. And it is basically this, that as you consume more resources, as you grow up in your very nice analogy and move beyond the teenage years, what happens first is that the quality of the available resources begins to decline because you've taken the low-hanging fruit, because you've taken all those rich seams already and you've mined them. It's gone, it's blown. And now we're looking at a world in which actually the quality of resources is beginning to decline. And when that happens, you have to dedicate more of the available resources to getting out what's left, because it's harder work, because they're not such rich seams, because it isn't such low-hanging fruit. And so you have to essentially dedicate resources that you might otherwise have put into health and education and community and building and production. You have to dedicate that energy just to getting out the resources to make all those other things possible. And that's a downward spiral. That's a place where you're beginning to actually have less capability to waste stuff, less capability to produce stuff, and potentially less capability to be prosperous. And that was a very simple message of that report. It was a fundamental underlying dynamic of the resource-based economy. And yes, it did make some predictions for around about the middle of this century. Lots of people thought all the predictions were about the end of the millennium, but that was never the case, actually. And some of those predictions appear to be coming true, and almost all of the evidence suggests that the original work done by the Limits to Growth people was fairly accurate in terms of the level of resource consumption and pollution that would come about. And so we have in 1972 this report that nobody wanted, really nobody wanted to hear that message. And everybody from, you know, pop scientists to journalists to the presidents of the most important countries in the world got up in public to say, this is rubbish. We don't believe in limits. There are no limits to human ingenuity, was Ronald Reagan's response to the Limits to Growth report, for example. And while that may be true, that there are no limits to human ingenuity, that's not the same thing as saying there are no limits to our resource basis. Mm-hmm. And that was a fundamental point. It actually hasn't been refuted in the way that many people believe it has been refuted. And it's still a really important message. His principal message, I think, is to say that limits, rather than being constraints on human activity, are an invitation to opportunity, as Wendell Berry describes it, a way of saying actually there's a different kind of world, there's a different kind of model, there's a different kind of economy, and there's a different way of thinking about well-being and prosperity. And we're being invited actually into that conversation because we are really beginning to face those issues in terms of resource quality that the Limits to Growth people said. It was a really important report, a point in human history, actually, where we should have realized something that we hadn't realized up until that point. And that something is as relevant today as it was in 1972.
Really astounding, especially considering the technology they probably had computer-wise in terms of both software and hardware. I'm sure my smartphone would handily beat it in many dimensions.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a wonderful story about Jay Forrester writing, basically, or sketching the World 3 model, or the basis of the World 3 model, which is what they did the calculations on, the back of an envelope on his journey home from the Club of Rome meeting in 1968-69. And that was the extent of it wasn't in the entire extent, because they did have some computing power, but they didn't have the data that we have today. They didn't have the geological observation that we have today. They didn't have the sheer computing power that we have access to in any way whatsoever. And so it was an extraordinary piece of work, really visionary.
Absolutely. Now, this comes up against an idea of a concept of planetary boundaries. Could you help us understand that?
Yeah, the point about the Limits to Growth work, I suppose, in those early days, that it mainly focused on resource quality. It did say a little bit about pollution, because the flip side of using and abusing resources is that you spread them out into the environment and they have environmental impacts. Carbon is the most obvious one. And interestingly, carbon was mentioned in the Limits to Growth report, but only in passing as a local pollutant, because we hadn't at that point cottoned on to the fact that we have the potential to create much more global damage through climate change from carbon emissions. And towards the end of the last millennium, it began to be sort of abundantly clear, actually, that those environmental issues were going to be driving constraints on human society as much, perhaps more than, the constraints around resources. And this idea that there are planetary boundaries was put together actually by a group of scientists based around the Stockholm Resilience Institute, led by Johan Rockström, and they set out for the first time at the beginning of this millennium to define actually what those boundaries might be. And what's fascinating actually about their work, when they published it almost at exactly the same time as Prosperity Without Growth was published, funnily enough, was that climate change, although it is an incredibly important planetary boundary, is not the only place where we're stepping over the mark, and that actually issues like biodiversity, the loss of species, the eutrophication of water sources, and the proliferation of genetic materials, these kinds of issues are places where we are already transcending the safe operating space of the planet. We're already creating too much impact on the planet, and that's a real force to think differently about our economies.
Yeah, and it's such a devilishly tricky thing. There was a wonderful piece of work that came out from an environmental reporter in the Denver Post talking about the Ogallala Aquifer System, and all the farmers there across this six-state system that are impacted by this. This aquifer, they know what the problems are, and they can clearly see it has a multi-hundred year recharge rate and that they're drawing it down way too fast. And they all get that. And the farmers even know that if they continue to do this, the very farms that they consider their chief assets are going to be ruined. And we're doing this to basically grow corn in a desert. Well, you know, high plains, it's a very arid area, maybe not a full desert, but it doesn't make sense. Everybody knows it doesn't make sense. And yet we persist. And we continue to do this, speaking, I think, to the idea that changing entrenched practices, even if they've only been there for a couple of generations, is really difficult to do.
It is difficult to do. But on the other hand, those practices do change and have changed. And And we're in a sort of constant cultural flux, in a sense. You know, our ideas about society, our ideas about the good life, and the interaction of those ideas with the technologies that we're constantly developing is not a sort of static picture. It's never a static picture. It's always changing. And actually, you know, that's both a worrying feature, a worrying fact, and also a very encouraging one. It's worrying because actually we've changed some of our cultural norms quite deliberately to build into society the idea of having more, the idea of consumerism. And that happened, you know, particularly after the Great Recession in the 1930s, the Great Depression in the 1930s, after the Second World War, this attempt to build a consumer society with very deliberately encouraging us to be almost profligate consumers, to want more and more, because we knew that actually the economy that we'd built needed to have demand in it. It needed to have more and more people demanding more and more things if we were to be able to go on employing people to produce them. And so there was, at the heart of our economy, was not just technology. It was a set of ideas about who we are and a set of ideas about who we should be that have dominated our conception of the economy and our conception of humanity over the last 50 or 60 years. And that was a shift. That itself was a cultural shift, a shift in the cultural norms. And what we're talking about here, I think, is actually saying, well, yes, that was a good-ish idea in the sense that it dug us out of the hole of the Great Depression. And it put together a sort of social project after the Second World War. And it saw us through, you know, perhaps to the last decades of the last millennium. But it is no longer the story of the 21st century. It cannot be. And it's not even a very good story about human well-being, because it turns out, in fact, that we're not just voracious consumers. And sometimes having more is worse for us. Having less is better. And those are the things that we have to try to find out now about ourselves, or rediscover about ourselves, in a world in which more and more is no longer an option.
Well, absolutely. The whole quantity versus quality discussion. And I'm an example of somebody who cut his living standard in half and doubled his quality of life. And it's a message I try to bring forward, that more is not better. And the data supports this, right? If we back up two steps in my country, the United States, whether we're looking at obesity rates or imprisonment rates or job place satisfaction scores or levels of depression, psychoactive drug use in children and teens alike, we can pretty much sum it up and say, yeah, we could do better. This is not a story of you know, really obvious happiness and contentment and fulfillment here. So those sorts of things are starting to sneak in, and generationally, I'm noticing that's really starting to sneak in as well, with young people increasingly being, as usual, sort of the revolutionaries who are saying, hey, wait, what am I buying into? I'm not sure about this. We can do better, and maybe this would serve me better. So that's a place where I actually have some hope in this, and I do see those stories changing. My concern, Tim, is that I don't know if we're going to have time, and I have a confession. I'm one of those peak oil people. I know we've been ridiculed, and there's a whole marketing campaign in my country to suggest that anybody ever believed in that was just a nut. But my data is what it is, and it shows that oil fields peak and then decline irrevocably, and that we're into the source rocks, and that the return on energy invested for our most recent efforts are not as stellar as they were in the past, and all of that. Where do you stand on the whole peak oil issue at this point?
Well, I think you'd be in very good company, actually. I mean, there's, you know, very serious commentators from very established positions. So, for example, a report last year to HSBC Bank, which would absolutely agree with that although, you know, we're not looking at the absolute depletion of oil fields, we're certainly looking at the peak of many conventional oil fields. Many areas in which the exploration for new oil is slowing down, and questions of quality about the resources that are coming online that could bring back that peak oil argument much faster than we've come to expect to be likely. There was a lot of talk about it, of course, around about the time of the crisis, and peak, and oil, the price of oil peaked at $147 a barrel, which was almost inconceivable a decade before. But it peaked at that huge price during the crisis for a range of different reasons, not all of which were to do with underlying scarcity. But the one thing that told us is that when any kind of scarcity hits that kind of supply, the resource price implications are huge, massively disruptive. And to not take that into account, to sort of rule that out on the basis of a short-term optimism, euphoria about something like shale oil or the new alternative sources of oil, is really, really short-sighted. It's kind of like a business looking at the supply chain and sort of saying, well, you know, it seems to be coming through at the moment, not sure what it'll be like next week, but we can probably find something else to create our product out of, our widgets out of, and paying no attention at all to the fact that your suppliers are saying, hang on a minute, you know, I'm not finding it that easy to get the raw materials anymore. Perhaps you should think about looking for another supplier. We don't have another supplier. We're on planet Earth. This is it. And so, you know, it's almost like to be responsible, even as a society, we must be taking those things seriously. And I think we could be hit by not necessarily ultimate scarcity, but by scarcity related issues in our supply chains much faster than most conventional observers are saying.
My own back of the envelope calculations put us at about 2018 to 2020, somewhere in there. And it's just based on the fact that there's $1.2 missing trillion dollars of upstream investment in oil and gas that didn't happen. So there's supply in the future that won't be there. And Tim, the tightest data set I have in all of economics, which is often noisy data sets and correlation and causation stuff is hard to tease apart, is just this one, is the advance in real GDP graphed against increase in total primary energy consumption. And it's practically a perfect fit. And so you have that piece of data, right? And then you have this other piece of data that you know, models vary, but the ones I tend to believe say that total energy output from fossil fuels peak somewhere around 2030. It's a decade-long topping process. That's fine. But you look at the work of Vaclav Smil, who says, hey, we've done energy transitions in the past. Two things. We've always gone from what we'll call a worse to a better energy source. Wood to coal, that was magnificent. Coal's better. But those took 40 or 50 years for even partial penetration, saying that energy transitions take time. So you put those three pieces of data together in my world, and I say, wow, we're topping out around 2030. But for our financial system to not fall apart, it needs to keep growing exponentially, and it needs energy to do that, which means that from 2030 to 2050, we basically have to replace 100% of total peak output of fossil fuels by other means. Now, I'm not going to tell us we can't do it or anything like that, but I will say that I look at that data, Tim, and I see urgency. I'm like, wow, humanity would, if we don't want this to really become possibly quite dire, we'd have to take that pretty seriously. Something like the Apollo project times the Manhattan project times another whole number, like 100. Like it'd have to be a point of serious thrust. Would you agree with that? And second, do you see anything on a policy front anywhere that sort of comports with that outlook?
Well, we do see some of that sort of Apollo project type rhetoric, and I would kind of call it rhetoric at the moment because it broadly sits on an idea that we can keep the existing economic system, we can keep the economic and financial system, we can keep that idea of economic growth, and we can just technologize our way out of it with some as yet unspecified or sometimes actually very precisely specified set of technologies which can save us. And this idea that technology can save us is probably the most prominent response to that question of time. And I'm kind of looking at that and I'm thinking, well, the question here is not about the technology. It is about whether we can achieve that transition in this kind of society. And so I spend quite a lot of time in in the book, in Prosperity Without Growth, you know, looking at the kind of society that we have, the way that it's built, the economic mechanisms, the social psychology of it, the way that those two things actually combine forces in an almost, you know, potentially magical way, if it's all going well, to ensure that we have more and more stuff. But actually, when it begins to go wrong, they stop us finding the solutions. And I absolutely agree with you. I do sympathize with this idea that there's not much time to solve these problems. But what worries me about that is it's one of those kind of, you know, rabbit in the headlight moments. There's a tendency actually to react to those time-based projections with a sense of either apathy, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it, I'm not even going to try, or just despair, or potentially, you know, just this haunting paralyzation of the cornered beast, not knowing what to do. And I think for me, it's really important to avoid that. It's really important to say, actually, we don't know about time. We don't know exactly when the shit is going to hit the fan. We don't exactly know how long we've got left. And what we really need now is this process of reflection. These technologies are great, but are we really going to make this work in the kind of society that we have, or do we have to think differently about a different sense of prosperity, a different sense of society, a different sense of what it means to do well? And if we're going to do that, then we must start building that in a very concerted way, not in a frightened way, not in a way that, you know, we're going to be run over any second by this juggernaut, this apocalypse that's coming within a few decades. We need that task actually to be more reflective. And we need, the only way you can really buy yourself time to do that task is to sort of say, you know, apocalypse come when you may, but actually, with or without apocalypse, there is a real virtue in building a different kind of society now, a better society, one that is more aligned with who we are as human beings, which is more fitting to prosperity, and which will deliver us benefits whether or not we're going to face catastrophe in 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years. And that's, for me, that's the way I get round that time task, that time challenge, if you like, is to think of this as a project that is deep, is absolutely contemporary, and whose benefits will go on whatever happens in terms of that potential disaster coming down the track at us.
I totally agree. It's such a delicate balancing act, too. I understand the idea of not wanting to put the rabbit in the headlights and demotivate people. A lot of my listeners have taken very positive steps. They've looked at the data. They've said, well, if this is going to happen, where do I want to live? How do I want to live? How can I align my actions with this data and reality? And often discovering along the way, as I did, that when you do put the garden in, and when you do have a more energy efficient sort of a lifestyle, that a lot of other benefits accrue, and then they get to sort of be models and spread that out. So we have to be the change we wish to see. Now, the other side of that, I have to tell you that a force of almost darkness that I have to battle, and you mentioned it once, is this faith in technology. I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Professor Tony Seba out of Stanford, who came up with a marvelous report, very detailed, that said, oh, look, magic happens, and you know, there's no more internal combustion engines by 2030. Now, I don't know if he's ever run a manufacturing plant or he understands how much lithium actually exists in the world on a mineable basis. But leaving those realities aside, what I noticed was how easily that message was just spread all over the place. And my concern is that instead of igniting a debate, it provided relief to people who would email me and go, oh, look, see, you're wrong. You know, it's done, like as if it's already done.
It's all fixed.
Fixed, because we've got this brilliant 30-page PowerPoint that somebody put forward and we're done.
No, a very similar example. So the New Climate Economy Coalition of the Great and the Good telling us that technology can save us. And the day that was published that report a couple of years ago, it was tweeted by Obama. It was tweeted by the president of the most powerful nation on the planet. And so, you know, that's the appeal of that message, speaking loud and clear there. If we can save it all with a magic piece of kit, then for goodness sake, let's do it and get on with our, you know, high consuming lifestyles. And the message that in a sense is a more realistic one, is a more measured one, is harder to instill at some level, at the level of having it tweeted by the president of the United States, particularly now, I suppose. But it is an equally profound one, and it seems to me, and my experience of it is that although it doesn't have that appeal at the level of the overarching political conversation, it has enormous appeal in terms of ordinary people's lives, in terms of the quality of their lives, in terms of the way they want to think about community, in terms of the way they want to think about their kids' future. And that I think is a different kind of energy. It's not quite so sexy. It's not quite so out there. It's not a 30-point power presentation or a tweet from Obama, but it is a kind of a cultural shift. It's a conversation, as I said at the beginning, that's kind of waiting to be happened, that's wanting to be had by a large proportion of the population, much larger than I ever imagined when I first published the report.
That is astonishing. And this gets down to the central piece of this, which is around prosperity for me. It's really about shifting mindsets and belief systems. I, Tim, when I entered all this, I'm a scientist by training and I got an MBA, so I like numbers and all that stuff. And I'm a data guy, right? So I thought, oh, here's some data. This works for me. It should work for other people. I discovered, no, that's a very small subset of people who that actually works upon. For everybody else, I had to take this tour through behavioral economics and what we know about influence and psychology and all that, right? Because the limbic system seems to be in charge. And the example I give is that here in the United States, if you use hot water, almost without exception, approaching 100%, it's heated with fossil fuels, right? And there's this really amazing technology invented in the 70s called a box on your roof that's painted black, and a solar thermal works great. It turns out the sun heats stuff really well for some reason. And so as I travel around, I'll point out that, you know, as I fly in, I will see almost none of these on the roof of even Phoenix, Arizona, for instance. And they make economic sense. If you like local jobs in manufacturing, they make sense. If you like the environment, they make sense. If you like less dependence on foreign oil, it makes sense. All these reasons, they make sense. But we don't do them. And I raise that as a way of illustrating we don't need that next piece of magic technology because we already have stuff that's brilliant that we're not using. So if we're not using that, how are we going to use the next one that comes along, right? And that's really the piece where I've personally been struggling, is how to communicate to begin to shift that culture of it's a story, it's a narrative that we live by. I think in my country would go something like this: we don't have to worry about resources, we never have, so I'm not going to. And I think that's about as complex as the story gets at this point. So the real question then becomes, who do we team up with? Who have you found that's really capable of messaging this in a very sophisticated, subtle, and careful way?
Yeah, I think it's partly about messaging, and there are lots of people, I think, increasingly doing that, telling this different story. And some of them, you know, in very surprising places, like the conventional economists now recognizing that growth may not be there, like the politicians beginning to talk about a different kind of economy. But it's also partly, I think, about building blocks. It's about foundations. So when I revisited that report for a second edition of the book last year, what I really wanted to set out was, you know, what would this economy look like? What would its foundations be? And instead of sort of starting from an empty plate, starting actually from the building blocks that economists recognize of enterprise, of work, of investment, of the money system itself, and saying, what would these need to look like in this new economy, in which we did actually choose these technologies, which are less harmful, in which our desire for quality of life was not dependent on more and more material throughput. What would enterprise work investment money look like in this economy? And in the years since that commission report was first published, one of the most striking things is how many answers I've had provided to me by the people who are doing those, making those changes in those different areas. So, for example, you know, the way in which B Corps and social enterprises approach the subject of enterprise, or the way that impact investing approaches the idea of investment. And I was just continually astounded by how many different investment actors, I suppose, from different places, institutional investors, venture capital investors, impact investments, small scale community investors, would come to me with models of doing that investment differently, in which it would be possible to invest in those technologies that we need, and in which it would be better for people as savings vehicles over the longer term than the kinds of things that led to the crisis in 2007 and 2008. And underlying each of those things, a sense actually of real visionary change, so that instead of thinking about investment as we did through the crisis or before the crisis as a kind of gambling casino where the winner takes all and, you know, devil take the hindmost, actually investment is a much more fundamental relationship to us. It's about our commitment to the future. Can we reframe economics, was my question, I suppose, in terms of meaningful human interrelationships. And I think if you take investment and you think about it as commitment, and you look at the institutions to build that commitment, and you look at all the people who are out there building it even as we speak, you get an enormous sense of the possibility of change, of a place where things not just could be different, but are already being done differently by a host of really committed people. And that I find very exciting, and it goes way beyond this sort of simple idea of substituting a magic technology for a damaging technology, and is much more about integrating a real vision of prosperity into human society.
Tim, very well said, and I have to just thank you so much for the work you're doing in the world, and to everyone else who is on this team trying to sort out how humans can perhaps somehow gracefully evolve into this adulthood, a steady state existence on this planet. So thank you for your time today. And also, how can people follow you and your work more closely, and which of your many works would you direct them to first?
Well, my calling card, if you like, is Prosperity Without Growth, which, as I said, has just been published in a second edition mm-hmm. called Foundations for the Economy of Tomorrow. And I have a very privileged position in a way of having enough funding to build a research group around these ideas, which was CUSP, the Center for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. We're based in the UK, but we have partners actually all over the world, and we're always really keen to have conversations with people who are interested in these issues. So please do contact us.
Will do. And Tim, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks, Chris.